Previously on the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Every encounter I had with him, well, not everyone was great. Believe me, they were not great. He could yell and be dismissive. Yes. He could do that, and he did it to me. And I think he did that to test you, to test your resolve, to see if you would come back at him. I think he respected that. You know, he laughed so heartily when I made fun of David Falk. He just was thrilled that I called Falk the bird of prey. He would talk to me and say, well, maybe we would have the bird come into this discussion. No, he can't have that.
This is General George Washington, and you're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
So we can actually do a sports show today. There's stuff going on. Michael is 6 feet away from me on Uncle Benny's table, and just before we started the show, Michael, you were showing me from last night, and we'll talk to Tim Kirchen about this later. We'll have David Aldridge on and Tim Kirchen on. We'll talk to Kirchen about what is happening between the Tampa Bay Rays and the New York Yankees. Aroldis Chapman really appeared to throw a 100-mile-an-hour fastball right at somebody's head last night in the ninth inning. Yeah, a little bit over his head, but that's a scary thing at 100 miles an hour. And then Kevin Cash, the manager of the Rays, called it bad coaching. He did not call it bad managing. I was very aware of the where he used bad coaching.
Well, to manage the game, it did set up a swing and miss for strike three.
Yeah, and finally the Yankees won. The Yankees had lost six games in a row. But this what is happening in this short season is really different from a baseball standpoint. I could whine about the Nats. In fact, I will for about 30 seconds. They just don't hit.
They don't pitch.
They've changed the order. They've taken Eaton out of two, and they've moved Juan Soto up to two, and Eaton is now batting fifth or sixth. If Turner and Soto don't get on, as they did not last night, they were 0 for both last night, I believe.
Against a great performance, but yes.
Aaron Nola is a very fine pitcher.
And I think that broke two hits in 16-game hit streak for Turner.
Yeah, two hits in eight innings. But if they don't get on, there's no chance to score at all. And in fact, they didn't score. In fact, the Nats just did not score. They have no hitting, and they have no starting pitching. Although Corbin, if you're going to go six innings and give up two, you know that's a quality start. It's not terrible. It's just not terrible. But they don't. It strikes me they're never ahead in a game.
Never behind they're, early.
Yeah, they're behind early,
and usually in a big hole too.
Yeah. There was basketball on last night. I did want to talk a little bit about this. If you just watch highlight shows of basketball games, you watch people making baskets all the time. Donovan Mitchell and Jamal Murray, Donovan Mitchell for Utah and Jamal Murray for Denver, have been great in this series. They've scored over 50 points, each of them, in various times. They set records for how many points they scored. But last night, in fact, the two games last night, really bad shooting. And the Nuggets-Jazz game is a game seven. And here's the shooting percentages. The Nuggets are 31 of 83. That's really bad. The Jazz are 30 of 79. That's really bad. These are approximately the same percentages in a game seven. Donovan Mitchell is 9 for 22. It's not very good for a guy who you think is an MVP candidate and a superstar in the making. 9 for 22 in a game seven isn't great. You don't think that's great. Jamal Murray, 7 for 21. 7 for 21 in a game seven with everything on the line. Nikola Jokic had a very good game. He had 30 points and 14 rebounds. But I'm saying that last night, when people think there's no defense, or maybe it's a combination of defense and pressure, that wasn't very good shooting at all. In the other game, the Celtics are now two up on the Raptors. I know Wilbon thinks the Raptors are the best team in the East. They're down 2-0 already. And I like the Celtics, even without Gordon Hayward. I like the Celtics because they got four guys who can beat you. They've got Jaylen Brown can beat you. Jason Tatum can beat you. Kemba Walker can beat you. And Marcus Smart can beat you. Other teams don't have that. They're not tall. They're not thick. They're not a traditional team. But they crushed Philadelphia and the mouthy Joel Embiid. And now they're beating a really good team. Toronto had a great season. Fred VanVleet, who's been a good shooter all year. Fred VanVleet, 8 for 22 last night. Kemba Walker, 6 for 18 last night. The Celtics, 32 of 76. That just isn't any good. Toronto's worst, 36 of 90. It's not good shooting percentages. I just bring that up because I haven't been able to talk about sports for a long time, and this is the way we used to open shows, is talking about sports. So I just thought I would say that. Michael and I played golf yesterday. Michael, Daddy was terrible. His daddy's a terrible player, but I had fun. I did. I had fun playing.
Do you mind if I share something about your approach to golf in this COVID pandemic world?
Sure.
All right. So to limit your, I would say, interactions with everyone else, you bring your own snack.
I do. My payday candy bar and my own water.
Your payday candy bar and your own water. So it'll be the appropriate, maybe a granola bar, maybe a banana that you want to eat at the turn just to get some energy.
Payday. All natural. All natural. Peanuts and caramel exist in nature. All natural.
You put it in the front cup holder of your cart and you just look at it longingly for about the first 5 or 6
holes. No, 8. I open it at 8.
But you look at it and then you open it.
Yeah, I open it at 8.
And at 14, you go, I still have a little bit of that payday left.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I do.
That's a candy bar.
A candy bar, which I bring courtesy of my daughter, who sent me a box of paydays. Elizabeth sent a box of paydays, which if you look over your right shoulder, you'll see them on top of the attaché.
But you're putting better.
Thank you. Well, I'm not getting... I actually scored okay. I broke 90, which is my goal.
Well, that's great.
To break 90. You know, I was 87 or so, I think.
And your drives. I mean, they're
hit the drive
out 180, 190. Which is good for me. Some roll.
For an old person, that's good for me. So so thank you for playing with me. There was one, you had a fabulous tin cup situation at one point, which made me so happy on number 10. I should explain how this works at Columbia. This is the only two-tiered green at Columbia. There's a lower green and an upper green.
A split level.
Yeah, and the pin was on the upper green, and Michael's second shot went to the lower green. You got to bang it. It's skee ball, baby. You got to bang it to get it on top. But if you hit it too hard because of the natural contour of the upper level, it will go way down the hill. And you hit it how many times?
I hit it a few times. Now, to be fair, if this were a stroke play event, the goal is it's like getting out of a bunker. Get out of the bunker
and get
onto
there.
The green. So get it to the top of the level. But the pin is in the back portion of this upper tier. So there's really about
it's a very delicate landing.
A 2 by 2 foot spot where you can get it to stop and then take a sharp turn to the right. So I'm just trying to hit that. And the greens have, the speeds have been pretty variable. But no, I was not going to leave that green without giving it my best to get to that 2 by 2 spot.
Yeah.
And so I was there for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Michael took
it. For handicap purposes, I'm not allowed to take more than a 6 on this par 4.
So that was fun to watch for me. I threatened to talk about this the other day, and I will talk about it now. I had a grilling experience last Friday that I think I should share with people.
Just put it on the grill, Phil.
I have very little propane left in the tank. Okay, I'm going to grill chicken. Tracy is over for dinner. I'm going to grill chicken thighs, which I really like. There were 7 or 8 of them. Bone-in chicken thighs, which I really like. Yeah, yeah. I don't like skinless, boneless chicken at all. I don't like that.
You got to watch for flare-ups with the skin on.
Well, let me just tell you what happened there.
I'm sorry.
So I prepared it. I put them in olive oil and salt and pepper, and half of them I put... what's that sauce I like? The red sauce that I like. Open pit.
Open pit.
And half of them I put a rub on. Now, it's going to rain. It's clearly going to rain. Thunder clouds are all over the place.
Crank
and I don't have that much propane. So I want to do this as quickly as possible. I want to make sure I heat this chicken quickly. So instead of killing the middle burner, I had all burners on. We were up in the air. You know, wheels up, all burners on when I put the chicken on. I set it for 5 minutes, you know, to turn it. And about 2 minutes in, I notice a lot of smoke coming out of the grill, like really
And this is a new grill because of what happened a year ago.
Yeah, it's a lot of smoke coming out. And I go, I don't know that this is good. I'm not used to that. And I go outside and I open the top and it is a wall of flame. A wall of flame, fire erupting everywhere, chicken burned beyond recognition. And now I've got to go turn it. I've got to make sure that, you know, I've got to kill a burner. I've got to lower the other burners. And I'm angry. And I'm angry because I'm doing this right in the middle of a thunderstorm. I'm soaking wet. I'm turning burnt chicken.
Well, the rain will help the grease fire.
And I'm really, really angry. And I'm angry at no one but myself. And I do turn to people in my house and I say the following. Don't say it. Don't say a word. I turn the chicken, I put it on, and I get through it. And Tracy was kind enough to say, it's only the skin. You can get rid of the skin. And the chicken actually tasted very good. It was juicy on the inside. I mean, I'm not saying I discovered something, but I did it very well. But there was a solid wall of fire, maybe a foot and a half high. I was just so... It was through the grates. It was flying up in the air.
Well, luckily, the propane tank was nearly empty.
It was nearly empty, and then it was done. The next day, it was below zero on the propane tank. In theory, I did the right thing, but in practice, I did not do the
right
thing.
Yeah, knowing that you had a limited amount of propane, I would have had you preheat, and then I would have had you just get the grill hot.
Yeah.
And then I'd have you just kill, if it's a three-burner grill.
It's a three-burner grill.
I'd have you kill the two right burners, so you'd only have one burner on, but you'd already have the ambient heat under the dome, and you'd have hot grates. So you'd sort of be cooking at both sides, but not coming at it from everywhere using all the gas.
I mean, honestly, this was the kind of thing that if it happened anywhere outside of a grill, you'd have taken, you know, flame retardant.
So this reminds me when we,
so much,
when we first...
Did you ever
moved,
do that, Nigel? Did you ever do... You don't cook. Sean, do you cook?
Yes, I do.
Did you ever have that situation? Just flame and flame and flame. And just,
absolutely, yes. I took my grill apart
to
clean out all the char.
I knew something was wrong because of the color of the smoke that was coming out of the back and the sides. Yeah, the next day, all the grease traps were totally overflowing, and I had to get on my hands and knees and clean the deck, which, and I deserved it because
this
was
is like
wrong.
What happened at the beach where it has accumulated so much fat and but no, we first moved to our house. We had you over for dinner. My mother-in-law was there. This was before Walker was with us. So I'm a new homeowner, have a new grill. I'm doing the same thing. I get a value pack of skin chicken thighs from the Safeway.
Love chicken thighs.
And what I was doing to buy myself some extra time because I wanted to get some crispy skin, I was using the upper rack.
Yeah.
So I've got about 6 inches of room between the grate itself, so even more between the burner. So I thought I'm good. Leave the grill on a little bit too high. I have the same exact situation. I see it outside. No, I cannot serve this. I bring it in. You go, no, that's perfect for me. In under 5 minutes, I'm to the Safeway and back because I'm so embarrassed and refuse to serve that chicken. And I see you just peeling off.
I liked it.
Peeling off the skin.
Yeah, I like it. Well, I don't, you know, I mean, you can, this is the caveman gene that you can grill just about anything, including shoes, and people will eat them. I mean, they're just sort of happy to eat them because they've been grilled. Men like grilled food, although it's probably
I love that you still use open pit.
I do. I've used it for 50 years. I think I'm the only person who buys it. I mean, you know.
And to be clear, I do cook, but like you any do? Good English cook, I don't grill things. I boil about 95% of my food.
It's probably the way to go. All right, so we'll take a break. When we come back, David Aldridge will join us. Lots of stuff, obviously, in D.C. To talk about. And after that, Tim Kirkjian will join us. I am Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show.
Tony Kornheiser Show.
This is a Simply Safe ad. Here's the thing about home security companies. Most trap you with high prices, tricky contracts, and lousy customer support. So while there are a lot of options out there, there's only one brainer, Simply Safe. And then it says, please feel free to share your own experiences with Simply Safe. We have Simply Safe. If we ever get back to the studio at WMAL, we have installed Simply Safe. And actually now, if it's still running, and I hope it's still running, it's taped all the people who've stuck their faces and heads and filthy hands into that studio.
Changing the dials.
And who
Nigel's
have ruined
board.
That studio and switching have made it impossible to get into. And we have proof, and we can demand that they be fired, which is the first
they
thing.
They did switch out our good chairs.
Yeah, this is the first thing that we demand. That when we get back, we'll say, we've been gone for a long
but
time.
Tape.
We're back now, but we have these miscreants on tape, and you need to get rid of them. Simply Safe's got everything you need to protect your home with none of the drawbacks of traditional home security. It's got an arsenal of sensors and cameras to blanket every room, or in our case, that one room, the studio. Every room, window, and door tailored specifically for your home. Professional monitoring keeps watch day and night, ready to send police, fire, or medical professionals if there's an emergency. You can set it up yourself in under an hour. You just peel and stick the sensors exactly where you need them. No technician required. And Michael, you and Nigel did it.
We did.
So you know what you're doing. And there's no contract, no pushy sales guys, no hidden fees, no fine print. All of this starts at $15 a month. I'm not the only one who thinks Simply Safe is great. U.S. News & World Report named it the best overall home security of 2020. So try Simply Safe today at simplysafe.com/Tony. It's spelled S-I-M-P-L-I, Simply Safe. You get free shipping and a 60-day risk-free trial. There's nothing to lose. That is simplysafe.com/Tony.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show.
This comes to us from Joe Canale, or Joe Canale, C-A-N-A-L-E, who signs himself SUNY Albany Class of 94, still waitlisted by Binghamton, as far as I know. So if you know someone, see, I could get you in now, I think. Hello, Uncle Tony. First off, thank you for the thousands of hours of entertainment over the year. My oldest daughter, Sophia, is a senior in high school and a musician with a voice so sweet that I can barely listen to it for very long without getting a little misty, which no one really wants. However, that doesn't mean you and the littles can't enjoy it. I've attached her song Red, which she wrote and plays all the instruments on, recorded and arranged by the talented Alex Burke. And he writes also, P.S. Ned Ryerson from Groundhog Day is named after Ann Ryerson, a castmate of Bill Murray and Harold Ramis when they were at Second City in Chicago. I've met her a few times, and she's a very nice woman. That's just so out of nowhere. It's such a sweet thing to write about. Completely out of nowhere. This is Sophia Canale, or Canale. I'm going to bet on Canale.
And sounds
this
like is Red.
Yeah. And very, very lovely. And she plays in David Aldridge. And we have so many things that go on in Washington that start out as local stories and then become national stories. John Thompson started out as a local story at Georgetown and had a success that was amazing. And by the middle of his coaching career, virtually everything he did or said was national news. Wilbon and I covered him. I think you covered him too. I mean, you were around him a whole lot. Mm-hmm. I imagine when you were at DeMatha, you hated him when he was at Carroll. I'm going to take a shot at that. But your thoughts growing up in Washington, and if there was ever a larger-than-life figure, well, there's two of them, really. There's Wes Unseld, then there's John Thompson, right? Those are the two.
There's a lot to unpack there. I did cover Georgetown when I first started at the Post. As I often tell people, I of course, did not get any All-American centers or, you know, championship-caliber teams. I had a team that went out in the second round, and Ben Guillory was my center. So,
right. He went to the NBA for a few years. He was actually in the NBA, Ben Guillory.
He had a cup of coffee in the NBA, but I was after Patrick and before Alonzo and Dikembe. So I kind of got, but, you know, obviously covered him. John was not at Carroll coaching. He played at Carroll.
Right, he played there.
In the 50s, I wasn't born yet. So he coached at St. Anthony's. I didn't know John at all at St. Anthony's at the time. I didn't hate John at all. I know he and Morgan Wooten didn't care for one another, but that was above my pay grade. So I like John very much. And as you mentioned, John became a national story. So by the time I covered him, you know, he was a top 20 national program and a big deal. And as you know, when you cover Georgetown, you're not covering the team. You're covering John Thompson. That's what you're covering.
If he lets you. If he lets you. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
up the stairs and through two locked doors, if he lets you.
It was a time, and it was a great experience, and he was a great experience. And, you know, as you say, if he trusted you, as you know, he was one of the great interviews of all time. And one of the most interesting and fascinating people of all time. But certainly Hoya paranoia was real, and it was at its peak in the 80s when they really got good. And he was remarkable. And in terms of basketball, certainly he and Wes were the two preeminent figures in D.C. sports in that era. You know, that post Dave Bing, Elgin Baylor era, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, They were the two biggest guys on their side of the street, and I covered both of them for a fairly long time.
The difference between Unseld and Thompson is that Unseld grew up in Louisville, and Thompson is a product of Washington, D.C., and on that Carroll team with Monk Malloy and Tom Hoover. Tom Hoover played a lot of years in the NBA, and Monk Malloy went on to become the president of Notre Dame. I mean, John spent his whole life in Washington, his whole life. I always thought, David, that he actually could have been mayor if he wanted to be, and that he was the best known person in the city, sometimes better known than the president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always the, you know, the, they say it goes president, quarterback of the football team, right?
Yeah.
You know, and then I guess him and Theismann, right? I mean, they were both pretty big deals back in the early mid '80s. And Riggins to a lot, you know, for different reasons, but no question, Tony. He was figuratively larger than life, and if he were so inclined, I'm sure could have had some political aspirations, but I never got that sense that that was something that interested John. What interested John, as you know, was making money and being a coach. And he did both of those things very, very well for a very long time. And his influence, you know, on the city, again, is, you know, well, it's hard to state it. You know, he was so constantly, presently there, you know, as someone that you wanted their opinions on things. And, you know, you like going after the biggest targets. And I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean, you just want to, carry with them, right? I mean, you want their best shot, figuratively again. And John would often provide that to people. Certainly, I know he respected you, even as you may have, you know, jousted with him on occasion.
Yes, of course. Sure.
You know, and, you know, so those he was a worthy target, right? I mean, he was worthy.
A worthy adversary, worthy adversary. There's a picture that I saw the other day when John left Georgetown and facing John, it's shot from behind John and facing him are younger versions of me, Boswell, and Wilbon. It's really, you know, it's quite touching. I mean, for me, the picture is quite touching. John won one national championship. Other people have won more national championships. But Jim Boeheim, who has won one national championship?
Yeah.
Jim Boeheim said the other day, he's on the Mount Rushmore. There's only space for four. I'm going to assume Jim is saying that because of everything that swirled around John for so many years and how he handled it, that he was just bigger than others, right? That's my assumption.
I guess. He means all-time coaches in college basketball?
I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could certainly make the argument. I mean, it's impossible for me to debate this off the top of my head. I mean, there are certainly guys. You know, you can certainly think about who would you consider. Well, obviously, you consider Wooden, you consider Knight, you consider Coach K, you consider Dean Smith.
You consider
John, right? I mean, you would certainly consider John. It's hard for me to say that. I'd have to think about it, but yeah, I mean, he certainly is in the conversation. Because not only of the victories, and to your point, I mean, yeah, he won one. He was 6 points away from winning three. So that's right. So
he lost to Michael Jordan as a freshman, and he lost to the greatest shooting exhibition ever in that tournament game to Villanova. So
79% lost by two.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
That's right.
So So it's he's certainly in the conversation, and when you add the social implications of John's tenure and his program and what he created. Obviously I've been talking to a lot of people about John this week, and I would love your take on it. The fact that John did that at a small Jesuit college, private college. I mean, he didn't have what he used to call University of Resources, you know, like
that's right.
I used to say you need one of them University of jobs to get the full the full resources that you need to compete in college sports, and he didn't have those, or he didn't have those at the beginning anyway. And to me, that's what makes it even more remarkable. I mean, this predates Gonzaga by 20 years, you know, and there's just not many small private schools that have become that level of dominant in college basketball, certainly not in college football.
Do you know what he had, though, David? What he had? He had the backing of the school president, the unswerving loyalty of the school president, and that means everything at a Jesuit school, everything.
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. That's what I'm saying to her. I know he came to get those things. You know, he came to be the guy that they would do anything for, and I get that. I just mean to come in like Mark Few did at Gonzaga to a school that has no particular reputation in basketball and to create a colossus is very rare at a private school.
Yes.
It's very, very rare. And so that to me is really kind of as important as anything else that John was able to do.
All right. I'm going to shift gears to the, it's so hard for me not to call them what I called them for 40 years and to stop and to say the Washington football team, the investigation that Dan Snyder ordered up into his own admittedly toxic culture towards women by Beth Wilkinson and her law firm, which was universally praised as the right choice, has now been taken away from him and is under the auspices of the league now. It may only be a small and subtle change, or it may be a big change. And I wonder if you're handicapping what this means for ownership, what do you think it means?
Well, I think it's a substantively big change, you know, and I tend to not buy the spin from Daniel Snyder that he, you know, magnanimously said, no, take this on, NFL, you know,
right.
I want you to handle it. You know, he was told that the NFL was taking over. And I think that, you know, it does give them some runway in terms of discipline, I think, that they may not have had otherwise. It's the same thing as self-reporting NCAA violations versus the NCAA coming down with, you know, with the full force of its calumny on you, right? I mean, it's just different. It's just a different degree of punishment there. So I think it is a fairly substantive change. Now, we'll see, Tony. I mean, you know, we know that the NFL has been very reluctant for a lot of reasons to really come down hard on owners that have transgressed. Other owners are very reluctant to kind of give their support to that sort of thing, knowing that their houses are made completely out of glass. So we'll see if they actually follow through with some, you know, significant Marge shot level, let's put it that way, punishments. You know, I doubt that they'll make, I mean, I guess they could make him sell, or they could encourage him to sell.
Right,
I think it will be very difficult to make him sell. But, I, you know, could they suspend him for a year and fine him with seven figures? Yeah, I guess. I guess they could. We'll see. You know, I don't know that there will be separation, which is most fans' dream, I think, at this stage.
Oh, yes.
Here's where I think it could happen, though, Tony, is that if – every municipality in D.C. makes it clear publicly that they will not build this guy a stadium. If you know, D.C., Maryland, and Virginia all say, independent with one another or in unison, that as long as Daniel Snyder owns this football team, he will not get a stadium built for him, then that may be a game changer, and that will, you know, compel, I think, Roger Goodell to kind of be more aggressive in separating the owner from the team. So, you know, I guess anything's possible. I mean, I guess anything's possible, but I would be surprised if it's a sale at the end of the day. I think it'll be
that's interesting.
Suspension. Suspension, but not a sale.
I wouldn't think that those three jurisdictions would act in unison, and I don't know that, I mean, economically, it may be worth it to get a new stadium one way or another. I have this discussion all the time. I'm sure you have it all the time because people want him removed. They do. Yes. And they say, what do you think is going to happen? And what I said, what I've said recently is, if I were his advocate, if I were his lawyer, I would say the following thing. I changed the name. You hated the name. I said I'd never change the name. I changed it. I hired a woman to run television and radio. It's never been done in the league. I hired a black male to run the team. It's never been done in the league. Don't you think I bought myself a couple of years? And that's what I would say if I was advocating for him. That's what I would say.
Yeah, no. And you know, he certainly has built a, you know, a buffer, I think it's fair to say, between himself and the, you know, the bad actors of that have been in his building. But that doesn't change the fact that they were in his building for 2 decades.
It was his building. His responsibility was his building.
Yep. You know, and so that's where the rubber meets the road. I mean, he's taking the Rivera defense, which is judge me by what I do now, you know, which Ron Rivera can do because he wasn't here. But Dan Snyder can't.
You're 100% right on that. 100% right. Let me shift gears. For many, 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 many years, you would be working now for TNT. You'd be at the playoff games. Yeah. Those playoff games were never, ever where they are now, in a bubble in Florida. Would you have been in the bubble? And does a part of you wish you were in the bubble, or you go, no, 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 not the bubble?
It's a good question, Tony. All good questions. I have said this to other people. The answer is I don't know if I would be in the bubble because I would still have very significant concerns about, you know, being away from my family for 3 months, that I cannot make decisions about unilaterally. You know what I mean? I'll put it that way. You know, that's something I'd have to talk to my wife about and my kids about, and, you know, we'd have to have a real long discussion about that, about whether that makes sense. But if I were still at Turner, and they would be perfectly within their rights, they would certainly, I think, expect me to be there, right?
Yes, I would think. I would think.
The answer is I don't know. I don't know if I would be there. There certainly would be a much greater chance that I would be there if I were still at Turner. Would I have wanted to be? There's a part of me that's curious, of course. Sure. I mean, yeah, I certainly, as someone that, you know, you've done this for a long time. You want to be where the story is, right? I mean, we all want to be where the story is, and that's where the story is. So, I mean, there's a part of me that would have been curious about what it would have been like. My main concern about being down there was the access, though. That was what worried me.
Very little access. Very little.
And it was kind of portrayed as you're not going to have any access. Now, we're reporters. We find ways to kind of get access to people, right?
Yes.
And I would have found a way, I'm sure. But that was my concern. Like, how much time will I really get to be in front of whoever, whether it's, you know, LeBron or Giannis or whoever it is I need to be in front of on a given day? You know, will I really get time with them? And it feels like you don't get a lot of time with them, whether it's a stolen moment in a hallway for 30 seconds. Is that worth 3 months of my life? I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So I'll leave you with this quote that we like to talk about, the Timmy Goodtimes, Timmy Bontemps quote, when he goes to register at the bubble and the desk clerk says, "So we have you for the next 78 straight nights?"
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So,
you go, oh, I hadn't thought of it quite like that. I think I'd like to be in the bubble until I wanted to leave the bubble.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's really weird. Thank you, David. Talk to you.
Thanks, Tony.
David Aldridge, boys and girls, we will take a break. We will come back. Tim Kirkchin will join us, and we'll talk some baseball. I'm Tony Kornheiser.
This is the Tony Kornheiser Show. Tony Kornheiser Show.
This comes to us from Ryan Posey and Daryl Hawken in Madrid, Spain. And they write, I can't play an instrument to save my life. Well, Ryan writes this. Granted, it's not as difficult as hitting a baseball, the hardest thing in the galaxy. But my buddy and coworker, Daryl, is super talented. We teach at the CASVI American School in Madrid, and we're fired up about the uncertainty of this new school year. Here's his newest song and his permission. The song is called Dopamine. I think I've taken that many, many times in my life. You can find him on Spotify as Daryl Hocken, H-O-C-K-I-N. Michael, if people like Daryl Hocken want to send in their music, and your dad from Albany wants to send in your daughter's music, how do they do it?
Send us your music by emailing it to jingles@tonyquinazershow.com.
Selling anything. What just are we selling?
Use promo code Uncle Benny at Johnny O. They have some new fall offerings, including some new casual sneakers.
You know, I'm wearing the shoes every day on the show.
And the sunglasses from their partnership with Revo.
Revo, I've got those sunglasses, which we don't need today. Tim Kirkjian joins us now. A couple of things happened last night that I think need to be talked about. The first one is the San Francisco Giants, who started out the year very poorly with Gabe Kapler, now seem to be a pretty hot team. And they certainly were hot with Colorado last night. They scored 23 runs. They won 23-5. Did you ever go to a game where a team got that many runs? Did you ever see that? I've never been to a game like that.
I've been to a couple of 20-run games. I think 22 is my high. Somehow, yeah, miraculously, I missed the 30-3 between the Rangers and the Orioles in 2007. Although I can tell you all about that game. But last night, the Giants had three guys with six RBIs. That's never happened before.
Fact, the Nats don't have anybody on the team with six RBI over the course of the year. So.
Right, and that was also the first game in which three guys had six RBIs. Alex Dickerson, he tied the Giants' record for most total bases in a game. He tied Willie Mays last night with 16. That's unbelievable. Wow. They went 27 for 52 last night, the Giants did. Think about that for a second. So I have a friend who thinks we should move the mound back 2 feet because it's too hard to hit these days. And last night we had a team get 27 hits. We had another team get 23 hits. Outside of that game, we had a guy have a three-homer game. Another guy had a five-hit game. So I think there's still a way to hit today's tremendous pitching. That's what the Giants showed us last night, because they haven't had a night like that since 1961.
Willie Mays got 16 total bases by hitting four home runs in a game. That's how he got it.
He almost had a fifth that day in Milwaukee. Lon Simmons told me if the wind hadn't been blowing, it would have, the fifth one, which got knocked down and caught at the warning track, would have been his fifth homer of the game.
So did Colorado take out real pitchers, and did Colorado put in position players at some point?
Yes. Drew Butera pitched the final inning and two-thirds for the Rockies. He's a backup catcher. Tony, these are the things that I know that no one cares about. He and his dad, Sal Butera, are the only father-son combination position players to have pitched in a major league game. So he's done it several times, and it's something that used to happen two or three times a year, and it was always cool. Hey, get this, a first baseman pitched last night. Last time it happened like 63 times. 63 broke the all-time record by a mile. This is where we are now. In order to save our pitchers' arms in games that are out of reach, we just throw a position player for an inning no matter who he is.
Wasn't there a rock group, Sal Butera and the Witnesses? Isn't that a rock group? Isn't it? Nigel, you need to look that up. All right, Tim, so you led me into an obvious question. The compression of the schedule, the need to play as many games as you can over a short period of time, and the coronavirus dictating that some teams can and can't play at certain times. It seems to me that people, players, pitchers, and hitters, people are getting injured at what looks like an alarming rate. How worrisome is this?
Well, the rate's been up for years and years now, Tony. It's a paradox. The more we protect these guys, the better shape they're in, because they all have personal trainers, the more they get hurt. But this year, especially, because this is a very delicate game, throwing a baseball overhand like that is not a natural human emotion, motion for the shoulder. That's why guys get hurt. But this year, truncated spring training, shortened summer camp, whatever we're going to call it, bunch of games in a short amount of time, it just is begging for more and more guys to get hurt. And it happens every single day. And I'm worried about it. I'm concerned about all of this. But this is the strangest season ever, and we're going to have to put up with this. We just hope for the players and for the game's sake that no player suffers any injury that, you know, really affects the rest of his career.
Is there talk about this? Does the baseball union, which is so antagonistic towards the baseball establishment, are they talking about the injury factor? Are they saying, you see, you're look what you're doing to us. You're going to ruin careers by doing this.
Yes, the union has been deeply concerned about the health of the players. You know, they're chefs now in every ballpark for good nutrition and all that stuff, but they don't have much of a choice here. They were the ones mm-hmm. who wanted to play more than 60 games. So
they said, tell us when we start and where to report. That's what they said.
And we'll do whatever you want. Well, now they're asking the Cardinals to play, 55 games in 43 days. No team has done that since 1945. So, yes, it's a risk. But if the players are going to get paid this year and then get paid extra in October, then they're going to have to play a schedule that, you know, pretty much guarantees that more guys are going to get hurt. This is just the nature of the game, Tony. We've been over this. If you get hurt, if you break a – if you have a tremendous blister on one of your pitching fingers, you're not going to be able to pitch in that game. People say, how can you not pitch with a blister? Well, again, it is such a skillful sport that if all the pieces are not working physically, you can't play this game. Whereas with all due respect, a defensive offensive lineman can tape up his arms and broken thumbs and play in an NFL game because he doesn't require the same dexterity with his hands.
Let me get to the Yankees. Let me get to Aroldis Chapman buzzing a guy right in the top of the head in the ninth inning last night, and Kevin Cash unloading without naming Aaron Boone by name, without saying it's bad managing. He certainly said this is bad coaching. He appeared, Kevin Cash, the manager of the Rays, he appeared to basically say this has to end right now and you people are the antagonists. What do you make of that? Because the Rays are a good team. Those are good teams.
They're really good, and so are the Yankees when they get healthy. Tony, I have no idea how Mike Brasseau got out of the way of that pitch last night. If you want to hit someone in the head, you throw it at the back of his head, right at his neck, and that's exactly what happened. It's a miracle that guy didn't get hit last night, and that's as scary as it gets. And it just I don't know what happened there, but Kevin Cash sounded certain that was done on purpose. And then the line he used afterwards, we got a lot of guys on our team that throw 98 miles an hour.
That is
naturally a threat that Aaron Boone didn't take very well, nor do I blame him. But this is what always troubles me the most about baseball, Tony. Let's say he did it on purpose, and I don't know if he did. The only reason he would have done that on purpose is that the Rays kicked their butt so many times this year and last. They've got the number of the Yankees this season and at Yankee Stadium. So the other team is better than you, so let's hit him with a pitch. If that's what happened, and I'm not saying that's what happened, that's the thing that drives me crazy. Three guys in a row hit a home run, so we're going to hit the fourth guy. They're better than us. They're beating us. So we're going to hit him with a pitch. That's the part of baseball that I will never understand and will always, always hate. That, hey, this guy's better than me, so I'm going to hit him with a pitch.
I thought it was deliberate, just like I thought Marcus Morris deliberately tried to injure Luka Doncic the other day in the next game. Of course, they threw him out of the next game. I thought it was deliberate with Chapman, and I want to know what the protocol is. Do you have to warn a pitcher, or can you just walk out and say, get him out of here? Get out of here. Get out of the game.
Yeah, the umpires can do whatever they want.
Okay.
If they see something, and they're all warned now, Tony, to issue warnings before a game. Hey, we know there's bad blood here. We're not putting up with this. But it is standard procedure to warn both benches. That was Kevin Cash's point, is you don't have to do anything. You don't have to warn anyone. You should throw that guy out of the game. That's what he was saying.
All right, let me get to trade deadline. We thought we were preempted the other day for the Major League Baseball trade deadline But there was only one big trade. Mike Clevenger, who I think was persona non grata on the Indians, was traded to the Padres. He's a pretty good pitcher. He is a pretty good pitcher, starting pitcher. Tell me what it says about the Indians and tell me what it says about the Padres right now.
Well, the Padres are demonstrably better now than they were four days ago, and they were pretty good 4 days ago. I had a GM tell me they are now the second-best team in the National League behind the Dodgers. They upgraded the back end of the bullpen. They added a number 1/2/3 starter in Clevenger, who can beat a really good team on the road in the playoffs. That's how good he is. They upgraded their catching. They upgraded first base/DH. They made a great deal. The Indians, on the other hand, got a guy out of the clubhouse that was apparently not welcome there anymore. They got a big haul in return with some young guys, and they still have enough pitching to win the pennant in the American League. I'm not saying they're going to. They certainly aren't the favorite, but their pitching is so good right now that they can still be a very dangerous team in October. So Padres got better. Indians didn't get as good, but can still survive.
So I had this conversation with somebody a couple of days before the trade deadline who is from Cleveland. And he said, what'd you think of Clevenger's start? And I said it was an audition to trade him. And he said, no, you're crazy. And I said, well, let's wait and see. Because that obviously is what it was, an audition to trade him. This says to me that Terry Francona really can do what he wants. And I know you know him very well, that he must have the respect of the players and ownership there in a tremendous way.
He does, of course. And he's the ultimate communications type manager. He talks to those guys. He knows how to get the best out of them. Tony, they traded Trevor Bauer, whose stuff is so freaking good, in part because he didn't get along with anyone in the clubhouse either.
Right.
So
right.
This is Terry Francona saying there's a bigger picture here than these guys are good. They're not as welcome here as they should be, and that's why we need to move them along. But they could only do that if they had more pitching coming, and they do. I mean, they brought up a kid, Tristan McKenzie, this year, who's really, really good too. So the Indians have a lot of pitching to deal with.
Can I just ask you to just leave us on the Nats and just, I watch every night. It's so sad for me. They really stink. They don't have any starting pitching, really. They don't hit the ball at all. I mean, FP the other night said, we're leading the league in batting average. It's just such a bogus statistic. It's two guys at the top of the order, and nobody else has any clutch hits, and they fall behind early and often. Should I feel terrible? Do you see any silver lining? Because I actually don't at this point.
Tony, they're 12-21. They're 8 games out of first place. No team goes 19-31 and wins the World Series 2 years in a row. It's not going to happen. They have a 5.11 ERA. After Corbin and Scherzer, their rotation has been terrible. They've had injuries in the bullpen. And offensively, you're right, they have the highest batting average in the National League. But only two or three guys are productive, Turner, Soto, and maybe Howie Kendrick. So don't worry about it. They did the right thing not trading anyone for anyone at the trade deadline. They start over next year with a healthy Scherzer, a healthy Strasburg, a healthy Corbin, and go from there. That was their only shot this year anyway. And when Strasburg went down, you said, all right, they can't outpitch everyone to the end, so let's not go trade for someone who can maybe get us to 500.
Thank you, Tim. That makes me feel better. Appreciate it. Tim Kirkchin, boys and girls, we'll talk to you soon. We will take a break. We have email and a jingle when we return, and I am Tony Kornheiser.
You're listening to the Tony Kornheiser Show. The Tony Kornheiser Show.
That is Jay Covington in Ellerbe, North Carolina, and he's playing his own accompaniment as he sings. That's very nice. Nigel, Bethesda Bagel ad. Michael hoofed it over there this morning. Why don't you give us the ad?
How are the bagels? Are you guys enjoying them?
Yes, very much so.
Well, that's because of the great bagels at Bethesda Bagels. There's several locations in the Washington area. Just go to BethesdaBagels.com. We go to the one on Bethesda Row at 4819 Bethesda Avenue. But as I said, look them up on BethesdaBagels.com. And I want to give you really full credit. It was not Sal Butera in The Witnesses, but it's Sam Butera in The Witnesses. So I'm going to give you credit for that one.
Now, I knew there was. I knew it was something like that. I was
big moment for me today at Bethesda. They recognized me from the door. So before hours opened, they brought the bagels out to me.
That's wonderful. That's
the avenue was abuzz.
That'll just do it. About do it for us today. Before we can get to the mailbag, let me just say, it ain't the way I wanted it. I can handle things. I'm smart. Not like everybody says, like dumb. I'm smart, and I want respect. Thanks to today's guest, David Aldridge, who you can read in The Athletic, and Tim Kirkton, who you can watch on television. Thanks to our sponsors today, Simply Safe. And remember that you can listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, radio.com. If you get the show through iTunes, please leave us a review. From Gary Schwartz in Vacaville, California. Early last week, my wife and I had to evacuate our home in Northern California due to a series of wildfires raging in our area. While my wife grabbed a few things to pack, my thoughts turned to where should we go? I quickly decided we would drive due north to Oregon and visit the wineries in the Willamette Valley mentioned on your show often, Willamette Valley Vineyards and Bells Up Winery. We called Willamette Valley Vineyards on the way up. They were kind enough to recommend a hotel for our stay in Salem, Oregon. Little's helping little. Salem, I believe, is the capital of Oregon. Attached are pictures of my wife speaking with Dave Spector of Bells Up Winery and both of us with the wine ambassador, Duska Jensen, at Willamette Valley Vineyards. They were both very welcoming.
Tremendous.
And Duska was especially attentive to our needs and wishes. Thanks for the years of enjoyment on PTI, the radio, and now the podcast. If you ever find yourself out in Oregon, I'm sure they will hold a welcome parade. Isn't that nice? That's nice. From Ed Butt in Frankfort, Michigan. How to fold a slice of pizza? Totally irrelevant. If you can fold your pizza, two things. One, the crust is too soggy. Two, there are not enough toppings. Just ask Wilbon. From Ben Ball in Newport, North Carolina. Growing up a Tar Heel fan, the biggest on-court rival was Duke. But the biggest rival for the soul was with Georgetown. During the 1982 NCAA championships, the collective voices of my father and three older brothers was window rattling. This is my favorite on-court memory, but not the memory of UNC Georgetown that comes to mind today. At the 1987 Final Four in New Orleans, I was there. I'm on the front row of the second level, and directly below us is the CBS booth. At halftime, Dean Smith and John Thompson come to the booth to talk with Brent Musburger. But my favorite memory is watching these two giants walk away when John drapes a loving arm across Dean's shoulder. By the way, I never told my UNC grad dad that I owned Ewing basketball shoes. John got along so well. He had his arm on Dean. He enormously respected Dean. He felt the same way about Carnesecca and Boeheim and Massimino and Gavitt in the Big East, all of them. Damon in San Jose, California, I think you lied to your audience when discussing how you eat pizza crust. You failed to mention that you like stuffing crust in your pocket and eating it at a Nats game. That's true. I enjoyed your stories over the years, but you pulling a piece of crust out of your pocket at a Nats game is the funniest of all time. Keep up the good work.
Not a payday. I have a crust.
From Gary from Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania. Thought for completeness, I would mention the recent obituary of Mel Krupen, who I'm sure you knew as the front of the house man at Duke Zebert's and later part of the Matzo Ball War. I lived in D.C. in the mid-80s and was trying to get a handle on the social scene there and learned that being a somebody at Duke's meant a lot. Being from Philly, we didn't have such an establishment, at least not that I knew of, Reading Terminal at lunchtime. Mel seemed like quite the character with his one-liners. You want a table? Go to Marlowe Furniture. You want lunch? Stay here. They also related a line that he shared with the Post when his own restaurant closed. Now people I haven't seen for months and call say they're sorry. Everyone wants to say goodbye. Where were they yesterday? Keep up the good work, and also RIP to Big John Thompson. Mel Krupen was a character. Krupen's had great matzo ball soup. They really did. This is real long. From John Agliata or Agliata in Wentzville, Missouri. I'll try to read it. I was saddened by the news of the death of John Thompson. I had the honor to talk to him once on the phone. I was covering Drake University basketball as sports editor on the campus paper. The program was under the coaching leadership of Rudy Washington. The program was involved in a recruiting scandal involving potential improper benefits to a player. Coach Washington and the sports information director called me after some of my reporting on the scandal and asked me to come in and talk with him. We drove around in the coach's SUV and he talked to me about the recruit in question, who was tearing it up in his first semester on the team. When we got back to the coach's office, he said, "I want you to talk to someone." Coach Washington was in the Black Coaches Association, and if I remember correctly, was headed by Coach Thompson at the time. I had no idea who Coach was calling. All of a sudden, there was this big, booming voice on the line. I'd grown up in New York as a fan of the Big East. I was a St. John's fan, and Coach Thompson's teams routinely beat mine. Not all the time. I was shocked to be talking to this giant of a man. Coach Washington told him what we'd been talking about, and Coach Thompson was mostly silent. Then he said something I'll never forget. He said, "Son, what year are you in?" "Sophomore," I replied. "I want you to promise me something." "Sure," I said. "I want you to promise me that you'll spend some real serious time, and I'm not talking just about in college, but for the rest of your life, learning what it's like to be black in America." He went on to talk about recruiting players like the one who was at the center of the scandal at Drake, and about how he approached things at Georgetown, and how he had to deal with an almost exclusively white administration while trying to help kids in horrible situations. Honestly, at the time, I was well aware that this whole afternoon was a coordinated attempt to try to manipulate my coverage. But Coach Thompson, he was earnest about the things he said. You could tell this wasn't just about trying to get a program out of trouble. This was about what he believed. In so many ways, Coach Thompson knew 25 years ago what was going to be happening in modern times. And it took me a while, but I have started learning more and more about what it means to be black in America. R.I.P. Big John. That's lovely. Just lovely. If you're out on your bike tonight, everyone, as always, do wear white.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious. That ball was on the line. Chalk flew up.
Rhyming is for losers, 'cause the chain is always broken by the avalanche of colors. The mountain spiraling, wondering how I got here and why. Why? I'm just a speck on your flower, Horton. Who is he? I mean, I hear the elephants tell lies. Lie. I should be harder on myself. The sunscreen in my mouth doesn't cover up the burns beneath my words. I know I'm anxious, but who isn't nowadays? I'll only say what pleases you. I like the color red. Cinderella's slipper, it fell off, should have been quicker, but those evil stepsisters made a pumpkin out of her. So her pretty dress turned into rags, but who told her that blue was her color? I should be harder on myself. The sunscreen in my mouth doesn't cover up the burns beneath my words. I know I'm anxious, but who isn't nowadays? I'll only say what pleases you. I like the color red. I should be harder on myself. The sunscreen in my mouth doesn't cover up the burns beneath my words. I know I'm anxious, but who isn't nowadays? I'll only say what pleases you. I like the color red.
Everybody's talking about how they don't have dopamine. I'm a happy guy, and I've always been. Don't know how they feel or what they mean. Some of these things just can't be seen. Complaining and whinging about your self-esteem. Get on with it. Quit going on about it.
yourself clean. And maybe one day you'll get your dopamine. It's absurd. It's obscene. Give me some of that sweet
thank you.